The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
The difference really between Argentina and the United States is they look at the U.S. dollar as the gold standard because we're only inflating at a slow pace while they're inflating at 35 to 40%. The question will remain for me, what does that world look like for us when not only in Argentina but in the United States we're all operating as currency speculators to survive?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, David, are you a little bit fatigued from our trip last week? Argentina, Uruguay, you know, the insights that we found while we were there, just trading on the streets, talking to people, were amazing.
It's fatigue of a different sort. If I'm losing sleep or if I'm dreaming too much, it's because it was very intriguing what we saw, what we experienced, the conversations that we had, and what we walked away with. Many of the basic economic laws that you would learn in economics 101, 202, 303, 520, whatever the class is, we got to see in real time.
Well, what you're talking about, some of the laws that we were taught in college, Dave, in economics, I'm thinking Gresham's Law. We had a chance to actually see Gresham's Law in action. And that's right. You know, the law says that bad money drives out the good money.
And what that means is that money in circulation, when, for instance, the Argentinians are running a 40% rate of inflation,
because they're printing,
no one really wants to hold the bad money, so to say, the inflated currency. And so they try to get rid of it as fast as possible. Guess what goes out of circulation? Guess what people hold instead? They hold the good money.
You wouldn't get dollars back in change. Boy, I'll tell you, when we would pull a dollar out and buy something,
they wanted to give us pesos back in change.
Exactly.
Well, that illustrates something that's, I think, very critical. There are two markets that you operate in. You can operate according to the official market, and that is the white market. And then there is the black market, which they don't call the black market.
They call it the blue market, but that's the street rate for the dollar versus the peso.
That's right. So now we have blue is the new black.
Yeah.
If you're fashion conscious, blue is the new black. And if you're currency conscious, blue is the new black.
And the difference was almost double, Dave. I mean, the government basically is trying to convince the people that it's 8 pesos to the dollar.
When on the street, if you could get the best possible rate, it's 16. So now that is something that's very interesting because everyone is willing to say, I'm going to operate outside the system. But in a world of black and white, where the white decision is the good decision, the black decision is the wrong decision, guess what they've done? They've redefined the decision makings that they make and say, it's not black and white, it's white and blue. Does this make sense?
And it's negotiable. You found in various places how you had to negotiate for your rate. And a lot of that has to do with how well the business is doing. I mean, wasn't it interesting when we got into the van, when they came and picked us up, a lady named Maria was talking about the tough times. And she was talking about the good old days in Argentina. And really, all the architecture in Argentina that's still the nice stuff came from the 1920s, didn't it?
Exactly. It goes back to sort of the golden era, the late 1800s, let's say the 1880s to 1920 period. Those were the glory days. That's when money was flowing. That's when you had wealthy farmers with tracts of land, 50 to 100,000 acres, and they were shipping their products overseas. And those were the glory days. They would vacation in Europe and they would bring back their ideas of what they wanted the hometown to look like. And they said, I'll fund it. I'll build it. And they erected these giant, beautiful buildings that look like they're straight out of Paris or London or Copenhagen. I mean, you name it. These are beautiful, beautiful old buildings.
It was a high time in Argentina, but you pointed out something interesting, Dave. Even the cars, okay, you know, we look at Cuba and how the cars in Cuba go back to the 1950s, but really, even in Buenos Aires, the cars were 15, 20, 25-year-old cars. We didn't see many new cars, did we?
No, we didn't. There was an exceptional car here or there, maybe every 10, 20, 30 cars, 1 in 10, 1 in 20, something like that, which was new. Everything else, as you say, was a good 15, 20 years old, and they're just getting by with what they have. So everything looks a little rusty. Everything looks a little faded. Everything looks suggestive of a time when there was money flowing, but that hasn't been the case for a long, long time. You know, I shot across the border to Montevideo, the capital city of Uruguay, and it's very different. Much more of a broad distribution of wealth and with a stable currency.
They don't have inflation there, do they? Or nearly what Argentina does?
Not nearly what Argentina does. And so with a stable currency, you have a very different spending pattern. And I was seeing the average car, probably 3 to 5 years old. Very rarely did you see an old car. Because when you have currency stability, you also have the ability to arrange finance. And that is to say, you can borrow money. Consider this. If you're a banker, and I want to borrow $1,000 from you. If there's an unstable currency, what does that mean for you and what does that mean for me? For me, the borrower, it means that I'm going to pay you back over a period of time.
With devalued currency.
Cheaper and cheaper dollars, which means that you take the currency risk and I basically get money up front and pay it back at a discount.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is, in a place like Argentina, you have a very frail and broken, a shattered, in fact, banking culture, where you can't borrow money to buy a home. You have to be someone other than Ben Bernanke to borrow money to finance your home.
Because a bank's not going to loan you money that they're going to get back as worthless money.
That's right. Yeah. So you actually have sort of a shutting down of the financing structure. Banks play a very different role. Contrast that with Uruguay or even our own country where, you know, you can finance a car loan. Look at the numbers that we've had year to date here in the United States. Massive purchasing of cars. Most of it on credit, and a high percentage of the credit loans for cars have been subprime. In other words, you don't have to prove that you can pay it back. You just have to be able to fog a mirror. That's reminiscent of what we had in 2005 and 6 in terms of home financing. But the interesting thing is, we are assuming bankers in this country, the United States, and a place like Uruguay, just to contrast with Argentina, they're assuming currency values which are stable, or at least destabilizing on a slow enough time frame that it's still worth it for them to clip the coupon, make the loan, package it up, sell it off to someone else. And it changes the game completely when you're dealing with 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% inflation rates per year.
One of the things that really struck me, Dave, is you've got people who probably don't really do much in the way of mathematics, who can all do a quick calculation on currency exchange. Everywhere we went, these guys had little calculators. And when you would buy in pesos, it was no problem. They could do that transaction. By the way, it's very expensive to be an Argentinian trying to operate in an inflationary environment because you can't save money. So whatever you earn, you have to spend on whatever you need at the time. But what's interesting is, as an American, don't you find that it was fairly affordable? I mean, when you were using dollars, you were getting about twice what an Argentinian would get with pesos.
Well, that's right. And so it's interesting, just to go back to your comment about everyone being able to make these calculations, whether on a calculator or in their heads.
Yeah.
It's not high math, and yet we're not used to the currency conversion game being here in the United States. There, it's vital to be able to do that, to be able to squeeze out a few extra percent profit, because that may be what makes your month. So it was interesting, just as Adam Ferguson, when we talked to him a few months ago, he said that in the context of inflation, everyone becomes a currency speculator.
Yeah,
and that's essentially
right.
What we had is you walk into any storefront, and their advertising was not really to sell a product. Their advertising was to do a currency exchange and make the difference between what they were going to work for you and what they could actually get in the market. So the contrast that I noticed, I'll give you an idea. We walked into a leather goods store, and this leather goods store, we were told, had one of the best blue dollar rates.
Right. They didn't tell us it had the best leather. They said it had the best exchange rate.
In other words, this leather store was operating as either a money exchange, the equivalent of a Western Union or a cambio. It's just interesting that leather was the means by which they were moving money. And so they appealed to the tourist coming in, because again, an Argentinian doesn't buy a new pair of shoes every day.
Right.
This is really oriented towards the tourist who wants leather goods. They know that this is sort of one of the world capitals for beef. And if you're serving up steak, guess what you have as a byproduct?
Quite a bit of leather. Yeah.
So you go down there and you've got high quality leather products. But the reality is their business is only one third to half leather. The remainder is currency exchange. And so what I noticed, this contrast between companies or businesses that do high volume oriented to tourists, where the volume's going to be higher in terms of the product that you're selling, the spread, if you will, the difference between the real black market rate and the rate that they were willing to work at is much smaller. And then going into a wine shop, I bought a bottle of Malbec for us to enjoy. And it was interesting. The vintage was older. I knew the winery. And it was a 2009. Well, this vintage was about 3 years. I've released three additional vintages since then. That said to me, this is old inventory.
You said vintage every couple of years. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's older inventory. It's been sitting there. And with lower volume through that wine store, these are all assumptions on my part, observations made and assumptions and conclusions driven from them. But with lower volume of turnover in the product, they were unwilling to budge on their peso dollar exchange rate.
Yeah, I remember you were negotiating for the dollar exchange rate, and I think he only wanted to give you about 11 rather than the 14, 15 that you were getting elsewhere.
And so we were at loggerheads in terms of what the rate should be, and what he was offering was not particularly a fair rate. Of course, it was better than the official rate, which is highway robbery.
But he needed to make something up in the currency market.
As a currency speculator, and as someone who's sitting on inventory, losing money with time, because again, inflation is eating his lunch. And right. By the way, when he's paying his utility bills, it's getting marked up every year. So he's got to somehow make it up. And he's making it up with a wider transaction exchange differential with the currency exchange between pesos and dollars.
Well, and something that is interesting from a government control point of view. Okay, the government has already just staunchly said 8 to 1. Okay, 8 pesos to 1 US dollar. Yet everyone, Dave, just as soon as the van door closed, we were handed a brochure for a leather factory. We never came down with the idea of buying leather, but they were trying to teach us how to operate in the black market or the blue market immediately. That shows that the government's losing control.
And in terms of sentence structure, they didn't end the sentence. It may have been a run-on, but it was leather goods and fair exchange. I mean, it was sort of the same concept. And so this is where you need to go for fair exchange, and you might buy something. So there was a fascinating insight there, again, reinforcing this notion that everyone's a currency speculator in the context of inflation.
Somebody might say, okay, well, that's fine and dandy for Argentina. Why are we talking about this? But we have a currency, the US dollar. Now, it may be seen as good as gold right now in Argentina because they're ruining their own currency. But our US dollar, of course, has unsustainable debts. It's running unsustainable deficits. And we're ending QE3, probably going to see QE4 or QE2 infinity, really, by the time we're done. Americans are going to have to understand how they can operate around their own currency at some point in the future.
And it's also with insights from history. I mean, when we're critical of Rome for destroying the denarius, in our conversation with Joseph Tainter a month or so ago, and the collapse of complex societies, and you know, one of the things that he was commenting on in his book and in our conversation was this decline in the denarius. You know, on average, it didn't exceed about 2 or 3% per year. 2 or 3% per year over 100 years was enough to destroy the denarius. And I've reflected on that, sitting on the plane, scratching my head, thinking to myself, it destroyed the denarius, you know, one small cut at a time. And over time, guess what it did? It remade an entire country, an entire culture, ultimately changed the trajectory of their ability to operate and fund an expansion project. And that is continuing to take on more and more land, the Roman Empire. And here we are with a stated monetary inflation goal of 2% per year. We consider this in the modern era of money and finance, 2% inflation, we will tell you, is healthy and good for you. Take your medicine and shut up.
Do you remember what Adam Ferguson said about that? Okay, you asked about the 2%. He said any inflation is theft.
Yeah, smaller amounts over a cumulative period doesn't seem like much to you and me.
It's the slow poisoner.
And the difference really between Argentina and the United States is they look at the U.S. dollar as the gold standard because we're only inflating at a slow pace while they're inflating at 35 to 40%. And on a relative basis, we look like heroes. The question will remain for me, when the dollar as the quasi gold standard loses its sheen, What does that world look like for us when not only in Argentina, but in the United States, we're all operating as currency speculators to survive? And business is not really an excuse to move product. It's an excuse to trade currency and hopefully trade up and out as fast as you possibly can. I sat next to a business executive on the way down, manufacturer, large multinational corporation. You wear their shoes when you go running, I can guarantee you. And what he said is he manages all of the Latin and South American plants for this particular company. And he said, well, the company I work for gives me a 20% increase in pay every year. And I said, yeah, it doesn't quite cut it because we're dealing with 40% inflation. And for you and me, listen, a 20% bonus every year from last year's pay, the year before that, you accumulate enough 20% increases in pay and you'd say, you must be doing quite well.
Right.
And the reality is, in that context, he's not even keeping up.
Yeah.
So I asked him, I said, so what do you do with your money? And he said, well, I do the only thing that I can do. I buy real estate. And as fast as I can, I get rid of my pesos and I buy real estate. And the problem is I'm paid in pesos and there's a limitation in terms of what I can convert into dollars. So when I travel on business, I convert as many pesos to dollars as possible. And I don't care if I take a hit on the exchange rate. I'm just happy to be out of the currency and into something that's not the peso. But the reality is I'm very limited in what I can do because they control the amount of capital that comes into and out of the country.
Well, and the government says what you can and can't do. You know, we were in an agricultural area up in Cordoba for a while, and we found out that the farmers cannot hold wheat longer than 3 years. Why would you want to hold wheat longer than 3 years? Because it actually is a way of staying out of pesos.
The point is they've become their own bankers. You know, as a grain producer here in the United States, we'd say, hey, you want to move on down the road. And that's why we use the futures market to go ahead and sell this year's wheat before we've even planted this year's crop.
Right.
And you can do that in the futures market. You can lock in the current price right now and move on down the road. There, they would rather hold on to the product for as long as possible because it's like playing your own bank. They have a hard, tangible asset and they're not about to let it go at the official rate. And they know if they hold on to it long enough, they will have preserved value through yet one more year of 20, 30, 40% inflation. And so what is the government's response? Just as you mentioned, they put a limit as to the number of years worth of grain you can keep in inventory. And then you are forced to liquidate that grain into the open market, receiving the official exchange rate of 8-1 or whatever it may be next year or the year after. That is a very interesting world to live in. Fascinating to watch how people adapt to inflation and how inefficient and how ultimately it destroys productivity, because here you are thinking about how to survive policy decisions as opposed to think creatively about growing a market, growing a business, improving productivity. You are wasting hours and hours and hours every day just trying to make sure that the government, via the inflation tax, isn't getting into your pocket a little bit more, a little bit faster.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Please remember to send us your questions that you'd like to have answered over the next few weeks, as we'll have a show specifically devoted to answering the questions of our listeners. Send those questions to McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com. That's spelled McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com. Isn't it interesting, too, you have different educational levels and then, of course, different wealth levels, how they preserve differently. Okay, the man on the street is going to preserve in dollars. That's what he's operating in. It's a transaction-by-transaction basis. The person maybe one scale up is going to go down and buy jewelry. If you recall, we were told where the jewelry stores were. That's another unusual thing to find out. The person who moves up the scale from there, they're probably going to buy land, like what you were talking
about.
Or
an apartment in downtown Buenos Aires.
But these people can't move their money out of the country. They have limitations. And we've been asked, David, oftentimes, why do we recommend a gold holding outside of the borders of the United States?
Part of the reason is because capital controls ultimately are a sign of desperation on the part of any government.
Right.
And when you are running massive deficits, you're almost guaranteed at some point to have the wheels come off. And in that context, you know that governments protect themselves. This is, you know, the notion of Leviathan, and sort of as the Leviathan grows, it takes care of itself at whatever expense to, you know, everything that surrounds it. And does that mean that that is government, and this is not only ours, but any government in any time frame in history would steal from their citizenry? By all means, they will.
Of course they would.
Literally, by all means, whether it's inflation, that's a form of taxation, a direct form of taxation, an increase in whether it's capital gains or income tax, nationalization of assets. I mean, all of these things are ways that government takes care of itself in sort of the death throes. And what people don't realize is that in the United States, outside of holding precious metals outside of the United States, we already have quasi-capital controls. Yes, you can move $10,000 in and out, much more than that, and guess what you do need to do? You need to fill out a FinCEN report reporting exactly what it is, where it came from, where it's going. No problem making those disclosures. But very interestingly, where do you take it from there?
Mm-hmm.
You can't open up a bank account virtually anywhere in the world. I say cannot open up a bank account anywhere in the world. As a U.S. person, the world financial system has already cut you out. And a part of that is because the U.S. Treasury has erected a threat to their survival. Do you know what that means? Exactly. That means that the U.S. Treasury can come after you legally. If you are a bank or financial institution not following their rules, now this is again the presumption of a U.S. enforcement agency on, talk about extraterritorial, I mean, I can't
it's
even
hard
conceive
to believe,
of this.
Yeah.
Right, but that someone else in some other part of the world is subject to U.S. laws and customs, it's really, really interesting. That is the basis for people saying, fine, listen, we just don't need your business.
Well, do you remember Joseph Tainer was talking about the collapse of complexity isn't always a bad thing, but what really is occurring when complexity collapses is the cost of maintaining that complexity is no longer worth it. So you've got the same situation overseas. Let's say you're a Swiss banker, and you're just sick of the Treasury calling you every day and asking for more paperwork, and they're asking for more fines and this and that. There's a point where you just say, that's fine. Let's just get rid of all American accounts. Now, that is a collapse of complexity at that point, down to a lower level, but it's manageable.
It's manageable. It's beneficial to them. It's the equivalent of saying anything that comes from the Treasury needs to go to, you know, my junk email. It allows them to do that and move on down the road. So the question of why having assets outside of the United States in the form of precious metals is a very good one. Because right. We're watching in real time a country where anyone in that country would give their eye teeth for a few more dollars.
Right.
And if they could have those dollars someplace else in the globe, oh, would they do it? In
sure.
A New York second. And so their options are limited, in part because many of the wealthy families in Argentina didn't look ahead, didn't see what was down the road, and assumed that they would always be well-connected, be able to pay their way out, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, thinking about the gentleman that we spent a lot of our time with, he came from a family dynasty that assumed they'd always have wealth. And,
sure.
And at this point, he's working 6-7 days a week to maintain the standard that he has.
Right. Admittedly, a wonderful lifestyle, but in his late 70s, is probably working harder than he anticipated working,
right.
Given the fact that, you know, his family was, as you say, a dynasty, 100,000 acres of arable land, a polo team. He played professional polo for 10 years, traveling throughout Europe in the 1950s and 60s.
He had tea with the queen.
Tea with the queen. I mean, so this is very interesting that he's something of a working stiff today. And yet, just a generation ago, literally in one generation, the wealth was lost.
Right.
And he would say, the game changers were twofold. Number one, we made certain financial commitments which we couldn't afford. We wanted to live a lifestyle, the next generation did, that only the first generation could. We hadn't earned it, we were waiting for it, and guess what happened? By the time it got to us, we had accrued so many debts, just sort of betting on the come, hoping that the money would be there, that it diminished very quickly. And on top of that, then they dealt with something that was exogenous, outside their decision-making, which would have been the inflation. And so they had an inflation to deal with and very poorly planned intergenerational wealth transfers. And he said, you know, when our family moved from the country to the city, we lost control of what generated our income in the first place. We stopped paying attention to it. We assumed that it would always be there. And we lived not just the first, but then the second and third generation. So grandparents, parents, and grandchildren, we lived extravagantly. We built extravagantly. We traveled extravagantly. And ultimately, we paid less attention to our source of income than we should have. We lost that. We lost through the inflation, and we weren't prepared intergenerationally for this transfer of wealth.
Which absolutely plays right into the theme that you've been working on with our clients and on a book.
Book I'm working on Legacy.
Is legacy and thinking these things through.
The key there is, he said over and over again, I have rediscovered what we lost from my grandfather, work.
Yeah. And he was. He was very prudent. It was amazing to watch how he had adapted his patterns of behavior. He's a very hard worker, but he's also shrewd. Dave,
very
he was very shrewd and understood what he was doing. But there was a story, you were talking about the old money relative to the new money. And I think it's important to understand when you're in a government like the Kirchner government or any of these governments right now that are the sustainability of these large huge leviathans are sustained not on productive assets, but they're sustained just on printed money and deficits.
Well, I mean, not that we have to spend too much time on the food that we ate, but we did have some of the best Italian food I've ever had. Italian food in Argentina, what are you talking about? A huge Italian immigrant community there. It has been there for hundreds of years.
Right.
And it was absolutely fantastic.
Buenos Aires is a very European-feeling city. I mean, it's Italians,
this particular
French.
Restaurant had two locations, one in Recoleta and the other in Puerto Madera. And I went to the airport the next day, and the gal who took me to the airport said, oh, you were in the area where there's old money, Recoleta. And I said, so what's the new money? And she said, oh, well, that's Puerto Madera. And so, okay, well, what's the difference between old and new money? And she said, well, the old money is all agricultural. It was the fruits of the labors dealing with the land. We're a very rich country when it comes to natural resources. That's the old money. And I said, well, what's the new money? She said, politics.
Politics.
That's the only thing she said.
They produce nothing. They only consume.
You're basically talking about a reshuffling of the deck. You look at the stated amount of assets that are in the country, and now it's just a question of who can steal the most from whom. And you will have a beautiful place in downtown Buenos Aires, not on the basis of being born into money, working hard, growing a business from nothing as an entrepreneur, but if you can steal it by graft, theft, negotiation at the political bargaining table, then you are amongst the nouveau riche in Argentina. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. We ate at a sushi restaurant, it was a Peruvian and sushi restaurant in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
And okay, so Peruvian, Japanese fusion, that is sort of a new idea, right?
Right.
Versus just the old school Italian restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we had in contrast both the cuisine and the character of the people, the new versus the old, the young who are experiencing what they think wealth is based on, which is basically, how do we reshuffle the deck? How do we get as much of what exists as possible?
It's the well-connected.
We're not talking about creativity. We're not talking about production. We're not talking about business and entrepreneurship. Now, fortunately, Argentina experiences something of a rebirth, potentially, next October, when Cristina retires. Cristina Kirchner is at the end of her second term, and there is no third term. If there is a third term, there's a problem, a bigger problem in Argentina. So there is some hope, but as you mentioned, Maria, who we spent some time with the first day we were there, she talked about the good old days, she talked about them past tense, and she never really did mention even October and a change in politics with any degree of hope, because the sense is that politicians, it doesn't matter who they are or from what party they are, they're all in the same business of carving up existing assets for themselves and then creating a legal or legislative buffer so that those assets can never be taken back. And I just think to myself, gosh, I've known people in four different states here in the United States who've been in politics, and do you know what they do? The very same thing that she was describing in Argentina. They have sons and daughters who negotiate contracts and get a piece of the pie and then create some buffer by changing rules or changing this or that. And they solidify the wealth redistribution, and they use the public policy arena as a way towards self-aggrandizement and growth of their own personal balance sheet.
Well, and it's not just from the top down, not the largest of government. You know, when we got out to the country, when we got out of Buenos Aires and went into Cordoba,
We were in a town of 100
people. 110
people.
But the mayor had full control. And the mayor, we were told the story that the mayor, he had thrown a party with money that was supposed to dig a well for the community. And he threw that party, of course, to buy votes. And then when it came time that they needed the well,
he called somebody in Buenos Aires and said, I need to borrow some money so I can drill the well and I don't lose my job. I mean, I solidified some votes, but everyone knew that I was supposed to use the money for the well. So at the 11th hour, 59th minute, he drills the well. And guess what he had? A little bit more debt for the city, but guess what he also had? He delivered what he promised. There was the well, and everyone was happy with him because he threw the biggest party in town.
So from bottom to top, top to bottom, they play the same game, they understand, but it's all redistribution. And unfortunately, Dave, as we were there, I mean, Argentina really does look like an America. It's about half the size of America. They're resource rich. They should be much wealthier than they are. But unfortunately, every time they start to get on an upswing, the government takes the money, redistributes it, and does exactly what you're talking about.
You know, next month, we're having a conversation with Peter Bernholtz. He teaches economics at the University of Basel in Switzerland. And very fascinating guy. We learned a tremendous amount from him. And, you know, the two things that he points out, which I think are very interesting and sort of bring the focus back to the United States, there has not been a hyperinflation. He wrote a fascinating book called Monetary Regimes and Inflation, History, Economics, and Political Relationships. And he basically says there never has been a hyperinflation. Except from 1914 forward.
With one exception.
You're right, you're right. The French creation of the assignats.
Yeah.
You've had high levels of inflation in other periods of history, but never hyperinflation.
Which he characterizes as 50% per month or more devaluation of the currency.
50% per month is how he defines hyperinflation. 29 instances in human history, 29 instances from 1914 forward in a period where paper money has no gold backing it. And I think it's ironic that the dollar today is treated like gold, though there's nothing backing it.
Right.
It's just simply one more paper promise to pay. And the other thing that he highlights, and we'll go into depth with him on this, is the importance of budget deficits, because he basically says when you begin to finance a budget deficit with the printing press, it's game over.
It either leads to high inflation or hyperinflation. So of all those inflations, you never had a currency that was backed by gold go into a hyperinflation or even a high inflation.
Right.
And you never had a country that didn't pay for deficits with printed money. They never went into a hyperinflation or even a high inflation.
But we have the ingredients today for a hyperinflation. And so it's fascinating that the conversation amongst most investors is an either-or conversation where absolutes are sought. It's either deflation or inflation, and we must prepare exclusively one or for the other. And I think anyone who tries to prepare exclusively for one or the other will be terribly mistaken. Terribly, terribly mistaken. Because, you know, as we discussed with Russell Napier last week, and we'll continue to bring out insights from that conversation as we move forward, there is this notion of too much debt in the system and a collapse in the debt system. And there is this notion that Napier pointed to of a concerted money printing effort on the part of the world's central banks that never in the history of mankind have we had central banks all operating with the same machinery and playing from the same playbook. And so the notion that you have either or instead of both and is really a mistake.
Well, and most inflations start really going hyper when the economy slows down and it actually looks like a deflation is going to hit.
Right. And this is something that, again, we'll explore with Bernholtz, but this critical element of the budget deficit being financed directly by the central bank.
Mm-hmm.
The 29 instances in which we've had hyperinflation, this played a critical role. And I just look at QE1, QE2, QE3, and it's going to become painfully obvious as we move into 2015 that another QE is important too, so that we don't circle the deflationary drain, so that the Fed is not sort of written off in the annals of history as the group that watched us be destroyed by deflationary implosion. No, they will do their best, and QE 4, 5, 6, whatever they call it, and the number that follows it, this, I think, is where we hone in on the both-and understanding of the world we have and the world of tomorrow.
We've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.